Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll talk, of course, about the fifth anniversary of 9/11. We'll begin with Lawrence Wright, who graduated from Tulane University and spent 2 years teaching at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he has a cover article in The New Yorker about Al-Qaeda in this current issue, and we'll be talking to him. He's also is the author of 5 books. He's a fellow at the Center for Law and Security at New York University School of Law, and he was a co-screenwriter of the movie The Siege. His new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. And we'll also then be joined by the co-authors of a new book on Karl Rove. They are also the authors of the bestseller about Karl Rove, Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. We'll be joined by James Moore and Wayne Slater. And James Moore was a longtime television anchor in Texas who covered both the State House and Governor Bush and his brain, Karl Rove. He's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent, and he's been traveling extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976. And Wayne Slater, the co-author of this new book, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. Wayne Slater is a senior political writer and an award-winning reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Previously, he was the Austin bureau chief for that paper for 15 years and has covered state and national politics since 1984. And he's been getting some angry phone calls from Karl Rove. So we'll be talking to both of them in the second half of the first hour. I'm now speaking with Lawrence Wright, who graduated from Tulane University, spent 2 years teaching at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and there's an article in the current issue of New Yorker titled The Master Plan, about Annals of Terrorism, The Master Plan. And he's also, as I mentioned, co-writer of the movie The Siege, and his new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. And Lawrence Wright, it seems that since 9/11, 5 years ago, we have been goaded into an endless war by a hopeless fanatic.
Yeah, we have. The unfortunate thing, if you read the ideologues of Al-Qaeda, in December of 2001, they felt like their organization was dead. And it had been really decimated, even though the leadership got away. 80 to 85% of the membership had been captured or killed. And for the next 3 years, it was in a kind of zombie existence, scattered and in disrepute. And Iraq has certainly brought it back. And I'm afraid that we're going to be living with the progeny of the Iraq war for a long time.
Well, it may get worse, though. We may go into Iran.
Well, that's part of their plan for us, for sure. You know, the Al-Qaeda strategists are great readers of American political science. And one of the books, for instance, Bin Laden himself has referenced the Samuel Huntington Clash of Civilizations, and in great favor. He wants to promote a clash of civilizations. But Paul Kennedy, his book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, talks about imperial overreach. And this is central to Al-Qaeda's plan for America, is to try to draw it further into the Middle East, to bring Iran into conflict, and also Syria. They could achieve their goals through using us as a proxy.
Well, only because we're stupid and reflexive. And do you believe, or do you have any inkling that our leadership has any idea of how much they have taken and continue to take Al-Qaeda's bait?
No. You know, this in Bush's speech last week, he made reference for the first time when he began to talk, directly about Bin Laden and Zawahiri. This was very unusual for him, and he said, we read what they write. We know what, and this is the first indication that they were at least reading it. But sometimes it sounds almost like the Al-Qaeda, you know, strategist or a neocon think tank. They're thinking the same thing.
Well, there's obviously a symbiosis here, particularly in reading your article in the current issue of the New Yorker, Annals of Terrorism and the Master Plan, Lawrence Wright. When you say that the Al-Qaeda, and then particularly the new generation of Al-Qaeda operatives and strategists, are just salivating at the prospect of the United States invading Iran because the United States will be able to do for Al-Qaeda what they can't do for themselves, which is to bring down the Al-Saud family, to shut off the oil, and they're also salivating at the prospect of either the United States and the Israelis or jointly, one or the other, or jointly taking out the Assad family that run Syria, which will then make Syria fertile for the Muslim Brotherhood, who are allies with Al-Qaeda, right. And therefore, you know, I mean, Mike Scheuer pointed out on this program some time back that, you know, Al-Qaeda wants to have a sanctuary right next door in order to operate from.
Yeah.
And if they get into Syria, then they'll be able to raid Israel from the Golan Heights. So
exactly.
I guess the question remains, are the Israelis as stupid as our administration are?
You know, unfortunately, we're going to be living with the kinds of problems that we have in that region until we are able to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. And I think that Israelis oftentimes don't really think strategically about their futures. They're only thinking tactically about how to survive. And Al-Qaeda has never really done anything about Israel. It just exploits the issue. It sees it as a way of recruiting alienated and politically angry, stirred up Muslims. But it doesn't really have anything to offer because it was always opposed to the kind of secular leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. But all that said, we have 200,000 settlers who are holding the world hostage. And until that issue is resolved, we're going to have that as a recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda for a long time.
But Lawrence Wright, Bin Laden himself worked on his father's project of restoring the Dome of the Rock, Al-Aqsa. And apparently he did in that period somewhat identify with the Palestinian struggle. But, of course, what's happening now is that the Shia are in fact stealing Al-Qaeda's thunder, that Hezbollah and Hamas, sponsored by Iran. Every time you see a picture of Ahmadinejad and Khomeini and Sheikh Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, there's a picture of the Dome of the Rock. The message is unmistakable.
Yes.
What they're saying to the Arab world, and particularly the Sunnis, is that we are going to deliver Al-Aqsa, not these corrupt Al-Sauds.
Right. I think there's been an interesting interplay between Al-Qaeda and Iran for a long time. I write about this in Looming Tower when in 1979, when Khomeini came to power in Iran, overthrowing the Shah. This was a galvanizing moment for a lot of Sunnis who were not, who were opposed to the Shia, who thought they were heretics, like Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two man in Al-Qaeda. But Khomeini showed them that this was possible, that you really could take over a big country, a serious country. You really could institute a theocracy. And it emboldened them to act. And throughout Al-Qaeda's history, there have been exchanges between Zawahiri and Iranian intelligence and also the Hezbollah, who have trained a lot of the Al-Qaeda people. So it's been a fascinating period because the Al-Qaeda are Sunnis and they believe the Shia are heretics, and yet they're willing to work with them on a kind of limited basis.
And the Iranians, of course, have sheltered many of the refugees from the United States attack on the Taliban.
Right.
They were driven, including Bin Laden's son and some of the people that you profile in your book and in your article, also escaped into Iran. So there's clearly, I guess, is it the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
The other thing about that, Ian, though, is that to some extent, I don't know how much they are being given refuge and how much they're being held as hostages. Mm-hmm. To, you know,
the Iranians did offer to swap, apparently, when Mladen and company made those secret trips with Larry Franklin, the guy that was busted handing secrets to AIPAC. Uh-huh. Apparently, those meetings in Rome did involve, at least on the Iranian side, they were interested in doing a swap with, if you guys back off with the Mujahideen al-Haq, then we'll hand over some of these high-value targets.
Right. It's when one of the letters from Zawahiri to Zarqawi, who was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq before he was killed, he cautions Zarqawi about fomenting this kind of inter-ethnic rivalry and civil war within Islam because, remember, you know, we have all these hostages in Iran, and, you know, including bin Laden's son and Saif al-Adl, who is the al-Qaeda security chief. A Saudi press report said there were as many as 500 al-Qaeda members in Iran. I don't know if it's anywhere near that number, but, you know, there could be a lot of people there.
And when Khomeini did take over, one of the first things he did was issue a postage stamp honoring Sayyid Qutb, who you mentioned as he's basically the original genesis of al-Qaeda, and al-Zawahiri was his disciple, and he's the sort of brains behind al-Qaeda. So let's go through that little story a little bit, because this is a man who if basically the father of al-Qaeda, who went to school in Colorado in the 50s,
right,
and was appalled by young Americans on the dance floor with their breast brushing, and he apparently had a fixation about America's fixation with lawn furniture as well.
Yeah, he was a pretty unforgiving critic of America, that's true, but he came to America in 1948. And it was a time when America's standing was really high, you know, just after the war, and it was a non-colonial power, so it had a lot of moral standing within the Arab and Muslim worlds. And yet, Qutb he saw a different America. And, you know, Greeley, Colorado, it was founded as a temperance colony. So here was this teetotaling, middle-aged Muslim virgin. And you would think this would be a good place for him because, you know, there are no bars, there's a church on every corner, and, you know, it's an education school. He came to study there. He was horrified. For one thing, he was a dark Egyptian, and one of his classmates told me about an incident where they went to the movie theater, and Qutb at the time loved American movies. But the theater owner said, "You can't come in because you're Negroes." And one of them drew himself up and said, "We're not Negroes, we're Egyptians." And the theater owner said, "Well, in that case, come on in." And Qutb said, "No, if you will not let a black American in, this black Egyptian will not enter." So early on, he was cued about, you know, race being a central problem. But sexuality was also really unsettling to him. And you can read in his writing when he talks about it, he's appalled, but he's also really titillated. So anyway, this guy went back, and he wrote some very damning articles about America. But he also wrote a book called Ma'alam Fil Tariq, which means milestones. And that's the book that bin Laden and Zawahiri and all the al-Qaeda guys read. It's the Bible of their movement. He calls for a vanguard of young Muslims to purify their societies and take them back to the days of the 7th century when Islam was really pure and regnant and growing around the world. And that's the vision that animates this movement.
And, of course, he was tortured eventually died under, I think he was in Nasser's custody when he died, I'm not sure.
Well, Nasser hanged him in 1966. And, you know, the last man to see him alive was a labor lawyer in Cairo named Mahfouz Azam, who's still active, and he idolized Sayyid Qutb. and was his protege. As it happens, Mafusa Zam's nephew is Ayman al-Zawahiri. And so that year that Nasser hanged Qutb, Ayman al-Zawahiri started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government. And he was 15 years old.
And he's largely, as I mentioned, he's considered the kind of the brains behind al-Qaeda. And he himself was, I think, captured after, was it after Sadat was assassinated?
In 1981, right. He was rounded up with hundreds of other Islamists.
Right, and he made that speech from the jail.
It's really,
I am the true face of the struggle, and I am the true Muslim.
Yeah, but he was subjected to vicious torture. You know, to give you an example of the kind of guy he was a doctor, a surgeon, and when he was arrested, the chief of police, you know, came in and slapped him, and Zawahiri slapped him back. He's a very, very proud man, but after 3 years of torture, and the object of torture is humiliation, one of the most common words in the jihadi vocabulary, he came out of that, you know, really bloody-minded, as many of them did, seeking revenge and no longer caring about how much blood was spilled.
And it's assumed, I think, that he had a hand in getting rid of the Palestinian who was the Azam, who was in many ways the leader of the jihadis in Afghanistan.
Yes, Abdullah Azam, who was sort of the godfather of the Arab-Afghan movement during the war against the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan. And he was bin Laden's partner in the creation of the Maktab al-Kedimat, the services bureau, where young Arabs came to register and when they wanted to go fight. And that was the nucleus of what later became al-Qaeda. But Azam and bin Laden had very different visions about what they wanted to do. And, you know, bin Laden really had a dream of creating what was, in his mind, an all-Arab legion that would go off to fight for Muslim causes wherever they might be needed. And it was originally founded as an anti-communist group. He wanted to fight the Soviets as they retreated into Central Asia, and then the communist government then in effect in Yemen. So that's how it started. But Azam didn't want to concentrate all the Arabs. He wanted them to be spread out among other Afghan warlords. He was a great believer in Islamic unity, and he didn't want to separate into ethnic groups.
And he was blown up. But
yeah, I think that, you know, Zawahiri spotted bin Laden in Afghanistan, and I think of him being a little bit like Colonel Parker looking at Elvis. You know,
right.
You know, charismatic and wealthy young Saudi, and bin Laden had a dream, but he didn't have the organization or the men to carry it out. So Zawahiri did. He already had a terrorist organization called Al-Jihad, and although he didn't really share bin Laden's dream, he surrounded him with his Egyptians. They were army officers, police officers, technicians, engineers, doctors like himself. These were men with a lot of experience, and that became the core of al-Qaeda.
And as you were saying earlier, Lawrence, right, and which is laid out in your book, The Looming Tower, al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, there is, of course, a peculiar symbiosis both with the genesis of Qutb and Zawahiri and the growth of the neoconservative movement with Leo Strauss. Both of them shared a revulsion against Western decadence and ended up sort of taking this collision course where there's a symbiosis that may bring about a clash of civilizations. And as we were saying earlier, that the remnants of al-Qaeda, who the younger generation were upset that bin Laden brought the wrath of the United States down on them and almost destroyed them. And for all intents and purposes, bin Laden is a shadow somewhere. But there are obviously people following on in his footsteps. And their dream, of course, is for the United States to, one of them dreams is for the United States to go to war against Iran, which will then deliver them Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And they also would like Israel and the United States, or both, to take out the Assad regime in Syria. So here again, we are the neocons are playing right into Al Qaeda's playbook. So it's mystifying as to why these people are still in power. I don't know whether you probably missed it. You've been on media all day, but
true.
But the vice president. had the most bizarre appearance on Meet the Press this morning with Tim Russert, where he's just unbelievably boneheaded and still floating these old canards. So the feeling that one gets is that that we're just sleepwalking through history here.
Well, we have to create, you know, if you want to fight Al Qaeda. There are many ways of doing it. One is to point out that Al-Qaeda offers nothing to the people that follow it. I mean, it is a completely empty political vessel. There was a trove of documents that thousands of pages that American and coalition troops picked up in Afghanistan in November and December of 2001. Thousands. It's called the Harmony documents, and it's easy. You know, many of them have been translated, and you can go through there, page after page. Not a single page devoted to the politics of Al Qaeda. What would they do if they actually came to power? They don't. You know, if you sat down with Bin Laden and asked him, "What kind of economic model do you follow? What are you going to do about joblessness? What are you going to do about the environment? You know, female education." He's never given a thought to any of that. And the stark thing that the Muslim world really is in trouble, and it needs to be liberated. But what it needs to be liberated from are ignorance, joblessness, barren economic society.
Right. Well, they're caught between theocrats and despots.
Yes, and Al Qaeda is not the solution.
Right.
That's the thing that young Muslims who are so aroused and feel so angry at the things that they feel are being done to them, they have to reconsider the direction that they're going in, because there are solutions, but it has to do with creating hope. And if you took the 57 countries that make up the Islamic Organization of Islamic Countries all together, they produce less than the country of Germany, $2 trillion. It shows you how barren those economies are. And the same goes for their governments. They're so restrictive in so many cases. But Al Qaeda only promises to make things a whole lot worse.
But it wouldn't be able to succeed unless there was, again, a reciprocity, a symbiosis. I mean, every step that President Bush has taken since 9/11 has helped Al Qaeda rather than hurt them, except for the initial war in Afghanistan, which was largely conducted by the CIA and was very effective until Tora Bora, when they let him slip away. And that's apparently what's, according to your books, what enraged a lot of the young jihadis, was that he exposed them to this retribution. But the long and the short of it is that every step seems to be, particularly this enormous blunder in Iraq, has fed them, and they don't have an agenda except to provoke a class of civilizations. That's the ultimate dream, and it seems to me that we are sort of lumbering like a dinosaur towards our own extinction. I can't imagine a world where we do have a class of civilizations. It would mean, for a start, that we wouldn't have access to the Middle East and oil. It would mean that no Westerner could probably go to the Middle East. It would mean that Israel would be a Fort Apache. Yeah. And it would mean that the Islamic diaspora in Europe would be probably evicted.
I think all those things are conceivable, and the other thing that we really have to concern ourselves is the moral standing in our moral standing in the world, which is in many ways our greatest asset in fighting Al Qaeda, and I think we've compromised that. It's not beyond repair, but the repairs are going to be very unhappy. I think it's important what the Bush administration has done, you know, closing down those secret jails, you know, saying that they're going to put these prisoners on trial, that's the first step. It's embarrassing that they're going to talk about torture and so on, but, you know, we have to become a moral democracy once again and show the world that this is a better society.
Well, Bush has made us the United States of torture, though. I mean,
I was talking to a young Syrian filmmaker, and he said, you know, look, I live in a police state, but America's the land of the free. When I look at you now, I see us. And, you know, whatever, you know, I disagree that, you know, that I think a lot of the things that the country did to protect itself were necessary measures. I wouldn't sweepingly condemn the Bush administration for everything that it's done. But it's absolutely vital that in the eyes of young Muslims like that man, that we be able to restore the image of uprightness, of transparency, of a sense of justice.
Let me just stand by the statement to the extent to which I condemn Bush for politicizing the war on terror, for making it partisan, for dividing this country, for saying that there are people who, if people don't agree with his strategy, if that's not too kind a description, they're not patriotic, for them now talking about Neville Chamberlain appeasement. I mean, and, you know, obviously getting off on the wrong foot to begin with, with unilateralism, when in fact the problem's over there, it's not here.
Right.
So I think that you can't distinguish the fact that the hand of Karl Rove in this, of how they've used the war on terror as a form of political tenure.
And it's going to be really unfortunate, because we need to have a sober conversation in this country about what we're going to do in the future, and, you know, where we're going to stand on Iraq, and, you know, what our future behavior should be in that part of the world. It's dangerous in either direction. You know, all around us there are snares of missed opportunity, and we have to be aware of the fact that there's not an easy solution, but we have to come to a consensus in this country about exactly what we want to do. And the over politicizing of this very, very serious problem is something that I really regret.
Just in closing, Lawrence Wright, your new book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, has nothing to do with this ABC thing on tonight, this propudrama that is, believe it or not, it's the director is an evangelical, his son of an evangelical, Lauren Cunningham, who founded a right-wing evangelical group, Youth with a Mission. He's formed another group called the Film Institute, which is dedicated to godly transformation and revolution in here we are in Hollywood, the land of godless sodomites. So this is it. Believe it or not, ABC hired this guy with an almost non-existent resume. They gave him $40 million, and he's turned out, apparently, basically right-wing propaganda. And he's been mentored by David Horowitz, who helped develop this project. And we don't even know who's paying for it now, because somebody's buying the airtime so that they run commercial-free. So please tell me you had nothing to do with this.
I had nothing to do with it. I haven't seen it, but, you know, one of the characters in there is John O'Neill, who is one of the heroes in my book. And John was one of the few who early on recognized the danger that Al-Qaeda posed. And as early as 1996, he was saying that, you know, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were real threats to America. And the director of the FBI, Louis Free at the time, for years after that, kept reassuring the White House that Al-Qaeda posed no threat to the homeland.
By the way, I think, short of bin Laden, Louis Free is probably one of the most culpable people in America. I mean, that these ABC documentaries trying to pin it all on Clinton, that he's responsible for 9/11, but Louis Free, his tenure was just disastrous.
Well, I write a lot about the FBI during that time, and one of the things that was unfortunately characterized Director Free was the first act that he did when he took office was to throw his computer out of the office. And
they still don't have computers at work.
They can't even give them to church groups because and it's a very, very handicapped organization at a time when terrorist groups have become very nimble technologically, and that was a real bad signal.
Well, we haven't got time, unfortunately, to talk about further about your book, because you do not only do you profile John O'Neill, but you also profile Prince Turki, the head of Saudi intelligence, and Zahawari, as we mentioned, and also, of course, Bin Laden.
Right.
I thank you very much for joining us, Lawrence Wright.
It was a pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Lawrence Wright, who has spent 2 years teaching at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He has an article in the current issue, Annals of Terrorism, the Master Plan for the New Theorists of Jihad, Al-Qaeda is Just the Beginning. And he's also the co-writer of the movie The Siege, and his new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. I'm now speaking with James Moore and Wayne Slater. James Moore is the co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and the author of Bush's War for Re-Election. He's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent who's traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976. And Wayne Slater is a senior political writer and an award-winning reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Previously, he was the Austin bureau chief for that newspaper for 15 years and has covered state and national politics since 1984. Their new book is The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. And Jim, let me just begin with you. So far, I've been hearing some strange stuff about your book, and we only just got it, so I haven't had a chance to read it all. But what the headlines are seizing on is the exorcism.
Yeah, that's a funny thing, Ian. It wasn't technically an exorcism. It was a Catholic blessing. There were three priests there, Deal Hudson, did this actual liturgical ceremony, and there was joking, which he related to us in an interview, that that Carl had joked about sort of exorcising the demons of Hillary out of the room. It wasn't really an exorcism, but of course, as things tend to get filtered through the media, they get a little bit distorted. Kind of makes you wonder sometimes about the accuracy of what you're reading and hearing. But it wasn't an exorcism, but nonetheless, he did feel the office needed to be blessed since Hillary had been in there, and Carl had certain feelings about her and what she did, and he didn't want it affecting him.
So Hillary was the incubus or the succubus or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible.
And, of course, the other headline grabber has been that that Karl Rove's stepfather, who was effectively his father, when Karl was 15, ran off with another man to Palm Springs. And later, I believe, Karl Rove's mother committed suicide.
Well, the details on this are also getting fuzzed up as it makes its way through the media. But in brief, Carl was halfway through his senior year in high school and his father had just landed a job at Getty Oil in Los Angeles, a big job as a geologist after wandering the Intermountain West for years. And he came home on Christmas Eve and told his wife that he was gay and he was going to come out of the closet, and he left. And Carl said that, the way this was explained to the children was simply that they weren't moving to Los Angeles as they had all planned. And that was the end of it. Of course, it's difficult for us to believe, Wayne and I, having known Carl as long as we have, that he didn't know what was going on. But Louis Rove went to Los Angeles, lived openly as a gay man the last of his professional life, and then retired to Palm Springs, California, and had open gay friendships with other retired gay men down there, and we spoke on the record with some of his friends. And according to what they said, Carl had a very loving and caring relationship with his father, and he was aware of it and aware of his friends and had no issues with it. And of course, The only reason Wayne and I went into this, Ian, was simply because of the fact that the Republicans, and Carl in particular, have used gays and lesbians and bisexuals and transgenders as a target for wedge issues, and to suggest that they do not have the same rights as everyone else simply because of the way they are born, and they've tried to fight it with gay marriage. The conservatives don't want gay couples to be able to adopt children, and Carl has this position in spite of the fact that he had an open and loving relationship with his gay father. It seems hypocritical in the kind of thing that we were compelled to address.
And Wayne Slater, you've been in touch with Karl Rove over the years. You've covered him, both of you. I probably know him better than anybody in journalism. He's not happy with what you've written.
No, he's not. You're exactly right. He's called frequently in the last few weeks. He takes issue with this issue or that. He'll parse language to try to say something's not quite accurate. And he actually sent somebody to have lunch about 2 months ago, an intermediary, to raise questions about what he had heard. And that was that we were going to talk about his father. We were going to write that his father was gay. And the relationship, the good, strong, really respectful relationship that the father and son had for each other. He wasn't very happy about this, and I think he was trying in his way to head off that reporting. He subsequently has called several times raising questions in hopes, I think, of stopping, not publication of the book, but maybe amending what was in the book. But what we've written is accurate. What we've written, I think, is fair. And as Jim said, I think with respect to the father, it's relevant because it really does point up this practice, especially by Carl, over the years of using homosexuality, gay marriage, as a wedge issue against his opponents in order to elect Republicans, most particularly George Bush, and to defeat Democrats. And it really has become a furious debate, not only within homosexual communities, but within the political community. At what point can you have this kind of relationship in your family life and yet actively use it against political opponents?
And I believe shortly after burying his father, he went on the campaign trail to gin up this wedge issue.
That's exactly what he did.
Which I think they're going to do again. I mean, essentially, I think as we head into the Halloween season, apart from the fear factor, I think we're going to be seeing, the mantra will be, least we've learned today that the Republicans plan on going personal against all of their opponents.
Shame on the Democrats if they let them get away with this whole gay wedge issue when there are so many people within their own party who were born that way and who are apparently either repressed or self-loathing to the point where they don't have any guilt about what they're doing to other people's lives.
But as I say, we're heading into the season where we'll be told that lesbians will steal your wives, gay men will steal your husbands, and Mexicans will steal your jobs. So
right.
Welcome to this sorry state.
It's all about fear, Ian. Fear is what keeps has kept this administration and the Republican Party in power. And if our electorate responds to it again, we've got some serious institutional problems just about the future of our country, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt once said that there are two kinds of people in politics: those that help you get elected and those that help you govern. And it seems that we've never gotten, with the Bush administration, to the second part. We've only had political people. And in fact, the first person to break ranks was the first head of the Faith-Based Initiative, DeIulio, when he said there's nobody in this White House that has any interest or any inkling of policy. It's all about politics. And so in effect, you're talking about the right guy. You're really, in profiling and bringing forth Karl Rove, both of you are bringing forth the notion that this country is run by a political operator.
Well, and one of the best examples of that that we write about in the book is Katrina. The whole idea behind everything that Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and the conservatives are pushing is the idea that you don't need government at all except to protect the borders and provide some infrastructure and then get the hell out of the way. And as libertarian as that, and radical as that sounds, that's fundamentally what they believe. Now, if you believe that the tax cuts are important, then you also have to believe it's okay to get rid of institutional knowledge within government agencies and get and cut back personnel. And they were getting away with it all the way up until Katrina, when a non-responsive government did not have institutional memory or of other hurricanes or people with experience to deal with this, and there was no government to respond when Katrina happened. And so the ugly little secret that they had in the closet was visible for all of us to see, and it's fundamentally the same way today except for our armed forces. But, of course, they're fighting the wars on the cheap too now.
So if we have a public relations operation pretending to be a government or masquerading as a government, why is there no political opposition then? I mean, has the Republican mantra over the years about big government succeeded, and do people in this country really believe that you don't need government, that somehow the marketplace can take care of it?
In fact, one of the ironies is that that spending is increased. Our government is actually bigger under George Bush. Now, obviously, part of the reason for that is because of the war. But Bush himself and the Bush administration has rankled some of the conservative Republican elements, classically Goldwater conservative, Reagan conservatives within the administration or outside the administration, because they don't like the direction of the country. But the key here is something you touched on a moment ago, and that was the ability of Karl, particularly Karl Rove, to frame in the most effective way and to press political messages. And he isn't about public policy. He divorces the issue of public policy, or public policy and issues are things to organize politically around. And you see it all the time. You saw it in the enormous success that Ralph Reed and Karl Rove had, and we lay this out in the book in, I think, more detail than it's ever been written, the success in cultivating and motivating this most important constituency, Christian conservatives, religious conservatives, around political ideas. And this came at a time when Karl himself is agnostic. Karl told a friend in high school that he had grown up in an a-religious home. He told a friend here in Austin that he would like to be other than agnostic, but he could not be. That's who he is. The interesting thing about that is the marvelous success that he's had in cultivating messages, particularly social conservative messages, issues of abortion, gay rights, free expression of religion in public life, as a political tool to elect Republicans. He's able to divorce himself from his own attitudes, or in this case, lack of religiosity, and to use religious people not because he fundamentally believes that the issues of faith have a place in our public policy, but because the people who associate themselves with strong conservative religious values are really susceptible to being herded in a direction to elect Republicans. We've seen both sides try to do this kind of thing. No one has been so successful as Karl.
But is there a bottomless pit of evangelicals or neo-theocrats in this country? I mean, I know that they've turned, Karl Rove's turned the Christian churches into a giant, gigantic vote delivery system. Is it infinite? Is it because the secular people aren't voting? I mean, I just wonder, because I know that in the last 2004 election, Karl Rove said that there were 4 million evangelicals that didn't vote last time, we're going to get them. And lo and behold, they win by 3.5 million votes. So it looks like they got most of them.
It's not infinite, but the point is that his whole philosophy is 50 plus 1. And if you can keep your traditional Republicans and conservatives relatively happy And then you can energize the Christian fundamentalist base to turn out in huge percentages. Then all you get what you need just to get over the top. And when you see the advertising campaigns, as a, for instance, the swift voting of John Kerry, there were a lot of conservative people in the military who were giving serious consideration to John Kerry until Carl called out the swift voters, and what they did was bring into doubt his military record, which was his strength. And of course, Carl's always said you attack their strengths, not their weaknesses. So all of those conservatives, middle of the road Republicans who were contemplating Kerry, went back to their default position. Carl kept all of those people in place, and then he raised the gay issue of anti-gay marriage agenda in 11 states. And he got those folks to turn out in record numbers. Even, as we write in the book, in the state of Ohio, he increased the African-American turnout from the churches. The total percentage went up 3 or 4 percentage points in Ohio, and that's what helped put Bush over the top in Ohio. I think the larger question for this election will be if the Democrats are going to be able to find a way to animate all of those people who aren't just politically involved, but individuals who are the daily life folks like all of us who are out busy dealing with the stuff of life, and whether the Democrats can reach out to those people and make them not be afraid to vote against the Republicans.
But Wayne Slater, isn't it pretty clear though that this strategy has immunized President Bush, because in effect they're operating like the Mutt and Jeff police routine when they interview a suspect? One guy is soft and the other guy is hard. In other words, Karl Rove is able to mug the Democrats like Kerry on the low road, whereas President Bush, who's really the enabler and is sort of obviously enjoying it in private, is able to take the high road.
You know, you're exactly right. Both Jim and I remember the 1994 governor's race in Texas, which was Carl's first race with George Bush against Ann Richards, the incumbent governor. And there was a furious whisper campaign in which Rove was involved in perpetuating in East Texas, which took a toll on Ann Richards, raised questions about, again, homosexuality. It suggested this whisper campaign, this very orchestrated campaign, raised questions about whether Ann Richards had gays and lesbians in her administration, whether she herself might be a lesbian. And we saw that as an effective effort. When the top Bush campaign operative chairman in East Texas went out publicly and talked about this in the final weeks of the campaign, and it became, front page news, Rove succeeded on traversing the low road. At the same time, when we approached George Bush about it, he said, "I don't know anything about it. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm not going to criticize my opponent." So this good guy, bad guy, good cop, bad cop routine has worked for quite a while. And let me just say one other thing about the approach. This is not simply you divide the field, with my guys and your guys. It's even more sophisticated than that. And that's one of the things I think we've tried to lay out in the construction of this machine, this apparatus, this political apparatus, which has many parts, many, many elements in an effort to perpetuate Republican dominance in American politics beyond George Bush. That really was Karl Rove's larger goal. An example of that was how the president himself, at Rove's behest, in the 2004 race, went publicly on the issue of the gay marriage bans that I supported. He reluctantly did it, but he did it because Rove said it needed to be done. And we remember about February or March of 2004, President went public saying, "I support the constitutional amendment that would ban gay marriage," and thereby help motivate his conservative Republican base. At the same time, the campaign that Rove was running saw in the computerized system of identifying Republican voters that there were a number of women Republicans, especially in the suburbs and the exurbs, who liked the show Will and Grace. And so the Bush campaign, while on the one hand publicly was talking about gay marriage and a gay marriage ban, was at the same time putting hundreds of thousands of dollars in television commercials in key battleground states around the show Will and Grace, a show that celebrates gay life, because they understood that they were really approaching two different elements of a larger constituency. And as Jim said, together and with other elements of this constituency, it was 50% plus one, which is all Bush needed to win.
But why is it then that there are so many closeted gays in the high ranks of the Republican Party, like the head of the party, Ken Mellman? I mean, is this the tradition of J. Edgar Hoover? I mean, Hoover wouldn't have been dangerous, but for the fact that he was in the closet, it seems.
You know what we heard over and over, Ian, was this: there was almost a pathology for the response to the questions about that, and it was consistently, look, you don't get everything you want from a political party. You have to take the good with the bad. Or science is still not settled whether it's a choice or whether it's a biological determination. Or, you know, I'm doing this because I'm working from the inside to try to change this party and this agenda to be better. And if I was on the outside fighting them, then I wouldn't be as effective. I mean, there are a number of different answers that we heard over and over, and they all basically said fundamentally the same thing. I mean, it's about a desire to have power and influence, even if you have to ostracize people who are just like you.
Well, but it's like the ghost of Roy Cohn is alive and well. I mean, there's a really hideous side to the nature of people like Cohn and Hoover. You know, I mean, I'm not suggesting that Rove is quite in that camp, but you know, that's the thing that I find extraordinary is that that talk about exercising Hillary's ghost.
Yeah,
ought to start exercising.
Yeah, what I find reprehensible though is the whole notion that we are still at a point in our country where there are still people who believe that adult heterosexuals one day wake up and they choose to be gay and they're going to go out and marry someone of the same sex and have sexual relationships with someone of the same sex, and it's just simply a choice, a lifestyle they've decided to adopt. The idea that people still believe this kind of nonsense is just a little astonishing to me.
Well, just in closing, let me ask both of you whether you think that there are enough people out there in the electorate that will be actually concerned about the war on terrorism and the way it's been mismanaged, the huge and growing gap between the rich and the poor, the price of gasoline, which is could, you know, every time Ahmadinejad says something crazy, the price goes up and he makes money. So, I mean, talk about paying both sides. We're paying for both sides for this war on terror. The fact that the middle class is holding on to their home equity and the bubble might burst. Many, many issues. I mean, no point in going through them all. But in other words, are they going to be just distracted by these wedge issues, or are people going to show some maturity, do you think?
Well, I think it's we just really don't know. We know that the terror message worked in 2002 when it shouldn't have in an off-year election. Rove and company succeeded in gaining seats, gaining seats in Congress. It worked in 2004. But if you look at all the polls, there's significant doubt. You're right. A whole series of issues has created an environment, I think, and the polls indicate that, where American people are not happy with a lot of things. And ultimately, the question comes down to, will the American people buy the argument that Rove is pressing? And you see it with the president, President's man. You saw it with Dick Cheney on Meet the Press today, and you see it in many of the contested congressional races where Republicans are saying, focus only on terror, not on Iraq. If voters ultimately vote their pocketbook, the way their lives have been affected in all these myriad ways, and the administration's handling of the war, then it's going to be the end for this effort by Rove. But if Rove is successful with focusing attention and fear and the division of fear, then Republicans will win in November.
All I would add to what Wayne has said, Ian, is simply that if the Democrats cannot win in the current political and cultural environment, then they need to rethink themselves as a political party. But the larger part of that, for me, is that if our country continues to respond to what I view as an amoral effort to retain political power to conduct what I consider an immoral war, then if the country and the electorate in a majority sort of validate everything that's going on, it raises questions in my mind about the whole morality of the United States of America. And in fact, the larger question for me is, are we still responding to and acting upon the principles that founded our country, or have we become so short-sighted and narrow-minded that we don't pay any attention to those things anymore, and always we've all been scared to the point of where nothing matters but our safety? And I think I don't know the line, maybe it was Jefferson, that those who would be willing to sacrifice their liberty in order to have more safety and security deserve neither. And I think
that was Benjamin Franklin. Yeah,
I think that's where we are.
Well, thank you for joining us, both of you, and
thank you.
Book, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power, Wayne Slater and James Moore. I also thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Cuth, the assistant producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer. Bye.